Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
My high school is near an area with a lot of gang violence, so lockdowns were a rather common occurrence. However, the one event that sticks out in my mind when I think back didn't actually have anything to do with that. The only time I actually felt scared wasn't because of a fugitive or a shooting. It was because of a student who everyone already knew was dangerous. His name was Jason. He was one of those kids that was crazy smart, but had a lot of problems with authority, focusing, socializing, and so on. I'm sure everyone knows at least one kid like that from school. He got suspended for bringing a knife to school once, and then expelled the same year for trying to strangle a teacher with a shoelace. He came back the next year, though, after going to an intervention school for several months. Unfortunately, it seems like he came back worse than when he left. I got the pleasure of being stuck in the front office with him once, when we both got in trouble for different things at around the same time and ended up sitting in there together. The assistant principal was supposed to give both of us an individual talking to, but it must have been a crazy day because we had to wait for her to get through talking to someone else first. In the span of a few minutes, Jason talked my ear off about the kids he met in the intervention school, like pyromaniacs and drug dealers, and even gang members. They were definitely a bad influence on him, but honestly, I think he should have stayed there. He seemed like he belonged. He talked very highly of his experience, and he said he made friends there, which surprised me. I was actually kind of entertained by the stories of what he got up to with those kids. But then he dropped a piece of information that I knew was bad news. Jason told me that someone at the intervention school had helped him learn how to make a bomb. Right before I could ask him if he was serious, the assistant principal came out of her office and called Jason in. That was the last time, and really the only time, that I ever talked to him. It was really weird, because despite all of the stuff I heard about him, he was actually in a great mood and seemed very happy, even though he was in trouble again. I thought it was possible that he might get better. But I realize now, the only thing that made him happy was remembering the violent criminals he hung out with and thinking about ways to hurt people. By the third week of school, I'm sure he was dying to get back to that other school. That's the only reason I can think of for what he did, because otherwise it feels completely unprovoked, unless he really just got a pleasure from doing it. During second period one day, soon after the day I talked to him, he called in a bomb threat. He was apprehended quickly, but he refused to give up the location of the bomb, so the whole school was evacuated. I vividly remember the feeling of my stomach doing a flip when I saw Jason's clear backpack sitting against the wall of the hallway we were walking through. The inside was stuffed with a garbage bag, so I knew it had to be the bomb. I told one of the administrators, who radioed it in. I felt lucky then that it didn't go off when all those kids were filing out the building, packed in like sardines. I was shaking as I was walking out to the football field, but I was able to get a seat at the bleachers instead of having to stand. We were out there in lockdown mode for hours, baking in the hot sun and just waiting to go back inside. But the bomb squad had to be called in to take care of the bag, and the whole school had to be swept for other bombs afterwards. I went from being scared to annoyed, to bored, and then finally I was restless. I started horsing around with the people sitting next to me, pretending I was getting a heat stroke and needed to lay down. Nobody was buying any of my BS or making any room for me, so as a joke, I laid down across their feet. It was all pretty funny, and they were kicking me and laughing, but while I was down there, I saw something that petrified me. Something was taped to the bottom of the seat right in front of my face. I pushed a kid's legs apart to get a better look. And of course, He thought I was being weird until he saw the look on my face. He was sitting right on top of a bomb. It was a box wrapped in duct tape with a note that said, "This is the real one, I swear." I flipped out and jumped from the bleachers, twisting my ankle and causing a massive panic as everyone caught wind of the danger and fled all at once. With nowhere safe to run and 1,000 kids running out of control, the whole situation was almost disastrous. A couple freshmen got trampled and ended up with broken bones. Kids hopped the fences and ran out into the road, swarmed into nearby shops, and a lot of kids took the opportunity to just run all the way home. By the time the panic stopped, the school was basically deserted. I'm sure if Jason ever found out, he would die of laughter. What really makes it embarrassing, though, is the fact that it was all fake. None of the bombs were real. The thing is, Jason was totally smart enough to make real bombs and actually kill people. And the only reason he didn't was because his goal wasn't to go to prison for a bunch of years, but to go to juvie or another intervention school. All that fear and panic and wasted time was just part of a sick joke Jason was playing. What makes me shudder is knowing that if he had decided to go through with it, a lot of people would have died, and I would have very likely been one of them. Nobody was prepared for the threat. He pointed out a gigantic weakness in the school's response. His placements would have been extremely deadly if they weren't just fake bombs. I don't know where Jason is now, but I hope he stays far away from me for the rest of my life. There used to be this kid at my school named Blake. Blake faced a lot of bullying from pretty much everybody, both behind his back and directly to his face. It's not like he didn't deserve it, though. He was prone to violence and often got in trouble for screaming in teachers' faces, because he was clearly indoctrinated into some crazy ideas that went against what they teach in school. I guess that means it's not totally his fault for how his parents raised him, but that never stopped anybody. Blake was just as physically repulsive as he was in conversation. He almost got kicked out of school for harassing a girl pretty badly after she rejected him for smelling like hot garbage. If only that had gone through, then things would have ended differently. It started one day when I was in history class with Blake. He stopped the class to dispute something the teacher said about the Civil War, and it ended up becoming a huge thing. The teacher was pretty cold with shutting Blake down with the facts, humiliating him pretty badly. This led to Blake screaming a bunch of stuff about how the country had been ruined. Then we all collectively laughed him off and he stormed out of the school. That was a Friday. Over the course of the weekend, Blake posted a bunch of stuff on his Snapchat. Pictures of him holding pieces from his dad's gun collection, which he was known for bragging about extensively, and pictures of him posing in front of a Nazi flag, which was also his dad's, I assume. But the worst part of all was a photo of our history teacher printed out and taped to a cardboard box, which he used for target practice, with the caption, "Getting ready for school on Monday." The posts were pretty chilling. For years, people had joked that Blake would do something like that one day, but nobody ever thought he actually had the guts. Several people reported the posts to the school, but what they should have done was reported to the police. Nobody, including myself, took it seriously enough. If I had, there was no chance I would have gone to school until he was taken care of. At school the following Monday, from what I heard afterwards, Blake came to school late, during fifth period when we had our American history class. He wasn't able to get into class like normally. He was confronted by the school resource officer and a couple of admins who demanded to search his backpack. That's when he drew the pistol and shot the resource officer and ran off. I heard the shot from the other side of the school. Everything went silent. Moments later, the lockdown order went out. We all knew it was Blake. I looked at my teacher, who was white as a sheet. All I could see were the bullet holes in the picture of his face from Blake's post in my head. After a few seconds, he regained his composure and went through the procedure of locking the door and turning out the lights, then ordering all of us to hide out of sight. Not a moment too soon, either. We all knew Blake was heading for him, and all of us by proximity. I barely had time to think to myself about how those dumb lockdown drills weren't so dumb anymore. Blake made it to the classroom door in under a minute. He started banging on the door and screaming,
"I know you're in there, I'm not an idiot."
People started crying into their shirts to keep quiet. Others took out their phones and started live streaming or texting their loved ones, assuming they wouldn't survive. Even I started to think that way. I couldn't think of anything to do. I didn't even have the presence of mind to think of what I might do to fight or protect myself if he were to get inside. My mind was too frayed, and it all felt so unreal. The only thing running through my head was the fact that I was about to die while sitting on the tile floor of my high school, cowering in the darkness in a huddle of students that was about to become a pile of bodies. Suddenly, a shot rang out. The crying became screaming and everyone started to panic. In the moment, I made a split-second decision and ran over to the window, opting to jump from the second story, instead of just sitting there and waiting for Blake to come in and shoot me. A bunch of kids followed me, but then I fumbled around. Somebody else shoved me out of the way because I was taking too long and sent me to the floor. That's when I looked back through the door and noticed something. Blake was holding his face with both of his hands and the blood was seeping out between his fingers. The door handle on the inside was lopsided like he had been trying to break in. I sat there, staring, just trying to make sense of it. In the chaos, the teacher was yelling at us to get away from the windows and get back to hiding. He started calling my name because I wasn't moving, and that's when I blankly said the words, "I think Blake shot himself." I said it pretty quietly for how loud the classroom was, and I said it like a husk. But enough people heard me to stop what they were doing and go silent. A friend of mine ran to the door and looked out the window right as Blake was running away. I finally got up and stood there next to him. Blood was splattered across the floor, and in the newfound quietness, I could hear Blake's cries of pain echoing through the hallway. Stupidly, and against every bit of sense I had, I tried to open the door, but it was broken. Not just locked, as all doors are supposed to open from the inside. It was broken. We were trapped inside the classroom, but at least Blake was gone. Hours later, we were finally freed and slowly learned what had happened. Blake tried to open the door by shooting the door handle, but he ended up mangling the lock completely shut and causing an explosion of metal shrapnel, which flew up right into his face. A piece of twisted metal got lodged in his eye, blinding him, and that was the end of his rampage. A lucky break for all of us, and it goes to disprove the myth that you can open a lock just by shooting it. Blake surrendered before leaving the school and was tried as an adult. He'll be in prison for the next 20 years at least. The resource officer he shot also got lucky and recovered without serious lasting effects to his health. I came over from Serbia at age 13 with my mother. My older brother, who was 15 years older than me, had lived in America for a few years and he sent for us. My mom wouldn't be staying, although at the time I wasn't aware of that. Anyway, we landed in New York City and the plan was my brother would come get us. However, my niece decided to come early and my brother's wife went into labor shortly before we landed. My brother couldn't leave his wife, so he asked a coworker of his. They drove cabs to pick us up in New York City and drive us to New Jersey, where he and my sister-in-law lived. When we got to New York City, we waited in customs for what seemed like forever. We looked for my brother's friend but didn't see him. This was the early 90s and cell phones weren't as commonplace, and even if they were, my mom and I didn't have one. Suddenly, we heard our names being called and I saw a tall man. He introduced himself in perfect Serbian and explained he was a good friend of my brother's and told us about the baby. He said he'd be driving us the 2 hours from the airport to my brother's home. My mom relaxed and they happily began to converse about the baby and my brother in America. I, however, just felt off. This guy gave me bad vibes, and regardless of my brother's friendship with him, I felt distrustful of him. We drove for a good hour and a half when he announced he was going to take us to breakfast. We hadn't eaten in over 15 hours, so we were starving by then. We pulled up to a house, and my mom and I were confused. He insisted cheerfully that his wife was cooking us breakfast, and after that, we drove the rest of the way to the hospital to see my family.
My mom shushed me when I whispered something didn't feel right and told me that we needed to be grateful for the hospitality. We were led up into the house. It was dark and dank and dirty. Suddenly, I think my mom finally got a bit nervous and started insisting he take us to my brother. Suddenly, the guy grabbed my mom by the wrist and he told her that he needed a wife to take care of him in his house. And when he heard my brother tell the others at work she'd be coming to stay, he knew he'd found a wife. I at the time was a scrawny little scamp of a kid, and I tried pushing him off of my mom, but he hit me so hard that I saw stars. At this point, we were obviously terrified. Neither of us spoke English, and we only knew my brother's home number, and he was at the hospital. Also, in Serbia, you don't dial 911, so even if I could, I didn't know that's how I'd call the police. Anyways, he tells my mom she's to clean and to cook for him, and he takes me to the basement, where I was locked in what I now know is called the laundry room. I banged and cried and yelled, but it was so far down in the basement, everything was muffled. For a week, we were kept in his home. He'd lock us up in the basement after my mom cooked him breakfast, and he'd let us out when he'd come back home at 4. If we had to use the restroom, there was a bathroom, but that was it. Just a bathroom and a laundry room. It was freezing cold down there, and even us huddling together under a blanket did nothing. One morning, I discovered a small window by climbing on some boxes. I managed to open it, and my mother insisted I squeeze through it. I didn't want to leave her, and besides, how would I get help? I couldn't read nor speak the language. However, I didn't want to live like this for the rest of my life, so I did as she asked. I ran once I got out, and I'm sure I was a sight. A scrawny boy with no shoes, only wearing shorts and a t-shirt in the middle of November. However, that is what saved us, as several concerned neighbors tried to get me to come to them, and I wouldn't. I was terrified. I kept trying to get them to follow me. The police were called, and a very nice policeman tried to get me to go into his car. Then I saw the man who'd taken us drive up in his taxi. He saw the police and took off. That's when I made a run for his house to get my mom. Needless to say, the cop and his partner ran after me and my mother was rescued. It took another 4 hours for them to find someone who spoke our language for us to tell them what happened. A warrant was issued for the man. My brother was contacted and his friend had told him we had never showed and my brother had been frantically calling back home in Serbia to find us. He drove up to get us and to give the cops information on his supposed friend so they could find him. But they never did find him. Back then, before 9/11, it was easy for someone to disappear. However, it made me distrustful for a long time of people and their intentions. My mom grew homesick, and she ended up going back to Serbia. I stayed and finished school, and I ended up becoming a cop in the military, thanks to the nice officer that helped me all those years ago. I think of that guy who kept us prisoner every now and then, and honestly, I wouldn't mind meeting him now. I just don't think he'd want to meet me. This is a story about something that happened to me and my grandma when I was 6 or 7, so 2001 or 2002. For context, I'm a girl, and at the time I was living in a city that was somewhat small, but is politically important, so it always had an airport. My aunt was flying in, and as she had lived in another town for ages, we were very excited to welcome her at the airport. We made our way to the gate people came out of after picking up their luggage. Not sure if this has a name in English, but to describe it, it had sliding glass doors so you could see people inside getting the luggage. I remember being very chatty while waiting, and at some point, my grandma grabbed my hand real hard and gave me a look that just said, "Shut up." I thought I had said something wrong, but after a while, I realized she was trying to listen to the people that were standing right next to us. They seemed to be fighting a lot. Also, my grandma has always been very gossipy. I looked over at them, and they were an old man and a very pregnant woman, and were just discussing something which didn't really interest 7-year-old me, so I ignored it. And now some things get fuzzy in my memory, so I will tell you what I remember and then what my grandma told me happened. I remember hearing the old man scream something like, "There he is, I'm going to get him," over and over until this man comes out of the sliding glass doors. Then I just remember that people all around started screaming, and my grandma threw me into the ground and laid on top of me. I heard noises like fireworks and screams, and I felt suffocated both by my grandma and some sort of weird smell, and also by how hot it was under her. So I was feeling really bad and I started screaming. At one point, I tried to push her off of me, and for a moment, I raised my head and saw a lot of red close to my face, on the ground, and lots of people laying down, with hands on their heads. Everything smelled bad and hot. I don't really know how else to describe it. At this point, my grandma pushed my head quite forcefully to the ground and whispered, "Stop and play dead, now," in the most serious voice I had ever heard from her. I didn't understand what was happening before that, and I was quite angry with my grandma for being forceful. But as she said this, I began to understand that this was serious, and I got quiet really fast, while trying not to cry. At some point, she got off of me and all, but carried me to stay behind a large pillar. I remember feeling very shaky in the legs, as if I had no strength, but there was a police officer there who told me everything was going to be alright. There were other people there who looked scared too, and we just sat down in silence for some time, while we heard police talking and an old man crying and screaming very loudly. Then it got really quiet, and I remember being taken to a room where I had to say what I knew to more officers for a while, until we could go. When they took me there, an officer used his hand to cover my eyes on the way, and I remember feeling just angry and tired of being handled around. I tried to take his hands off, and I saw for just a moment the pregnant woman lying on her back. This image is forever in my head since that day. Now, for the details my grandma told me later on. She told me what happened only a few years back. At the time this took place, she just explained to me that a very bad man did bad stuff, but he was arrested, and I shouldn't worry. But as she explained recently, what happened was that the old man was the woman's father, and apparently she was very young and got pregnant by this guy, I'll call him Dick, who then just ran away and abandoned her. He was coming back because she had recently been in touch and had reconsidered about being a dad, except when her father found out about us, he was very angry and decided to take revenge on Dick for leaving in the first place. My grandma said she learned this on the news later, but in the airport, she heard the father talking about how Dick ruined her life, and how he had to pay, and how he wasn't going to let anyone treat her like that. And he kept telling him that she loved the guy, that he had come around to not do anything. I should add maybe that abortions aren't legal here, and that the only way to get one is either paying a lot of cash to someone to do it illegally, or getting sketchy drugs from sketchy people, which can result in a lot of other bad stuff. And as you may have guessed, her father had a gun, and as Dick came out of the glass door with his luggage, he whipped it out. And that's when people started screaming, and my grandma throws me on the ground, and also when everyone gets on the ground too. Except, he didn't just kill that guy. Apparently, he was too emotional, or he had never shot a gun before. Or both. Because he couldn't aim right, and he hurt some other people too, who took grazing bullets, or got shot in non-fatal places. While this is happening, the woman keeps screaming that she loves her baby daddy, and when her dad managed to aim right, she threw herself in the way. Both her, Dick, and the baby got killed instantly. My grandma said that this happened really fast, and the police showed up right when he shot them. This is when the old guy calms down a bit, or at least isn't trying to shoot anyone anymore. So there's a lot of police trying to get the gun from him, and people start to get up and hide. This is when we go behind the pillar. It takes a few minutes, but finally he lets go of the gun. Probably sad at his daughter and grandchild's death, and the police take him finally. I think it took the police some time to show up, because at the time, it was a very small airport. Low on crimes and such. My grandma said the whole thing happened in maybe 20 minutes, but to me, it felt like ages. As I only talked to my grandma recently, I hadn't realized how close we had been to the old man and his daughter, and that when I saw red just a few inches from my nose, I probably saw someone who had been hurt, so close to me, and was putting myself in danger, trying to push her off. I'm forever grateful that she protected me so well, and that I hadn't realized the situation we were in until recently. A little about me. I'm currently 22, and this happened when I was 10. I had a cell phone at the time, but only because my parents travel for their work, so I stayed with my grandparents while my parents were on the road. My dad was working a job in Austin, but my mom was home with me. I had a break going on in school, spring break, so my mom and I decided to fly down to Austin to see him. My mom is a smoker, and me being 10, she didn't want me in the cigar room in the airport, which was basically a glass box full of smoke. So we leave our gate and head down that way. Thankfully, there's a bookstore maybe 10 feet from the cigar room, which also has mostly glass windows. So my mom sends me to the bookstore and sits close to the door of the cigar room so she can see me. Before we parted ways, my mom told me to send her a text message saying, "I really want this book. If I got any bad vibes from anyone." Well, I am a reader, so I think I'll look for a while until my mom is ready to get me. There probably won't be any issue. After about 5 minutes of being in this bookstore, I notice a guy walk in. I really only remember his gray suit and black shoes. I notice his shoes come over by where I am, the thriller section, so I move away to another section, where he promptly follows me again. I assumed it was just coincidence, since I was still looking at more mature books, and I move over a few feet to another section, where they have books on racks in the middle of the floor, rather than on shelves on the wall. The guy moves over to the same rack I'm at, but the other side. My freakometer was going off like crazy, which is rarely wrong. So I do one last thing to test my theory of this guy, and I walk over to the little kid section, like Hungry Caterpillar type books, and the guy follows me again. I'm freaking out, so I go back to the thriller section, which is closest to the checkout desk, pick up a random book, and text my mom. I really want this book. Not 2 seconds later, I smell my mom's perfume and hear her say, "Oh, good, you found something." We promptly pay and leave. Once we were away from the store, I told my mom what happened, and she told me she had seen the guy follow me across the store twice and immediately walked over because her freakometer was also off the charts. She hadn't even gotten my message because she was already walking over. Before we go back to our gate, we stop at the ladies' room and I noticed the bookstore guy coming down that hall and silently pointed out to my mom, who went on high alert. After the ladies' room, we head to our gate where we see the bookstore guy sitting 2 seats down from our luggage. So my mom sat down next to the plane entrance thing and grabbed our stuff. After we board our plane, the guy is only a couple rows away from us. We can't really move because, well, it's a plane. Finally, we have a layover midway between Nashville, our first airport, and Austin. I didn't notice the rest of this, but my mom did. The guy got off right behind us and followed us to our next gate. My mom was just pissed at this point and ready to throw down with this guy, but won't because I'm with her. We verify where our gate is and our next plane's ETA and take off to the smoking area, another glass box filled with smoke, where she brought me in with her and smoked the fastest cigarette ever. Apparently, the guy had followed us across the airport to the cigar room and just stood outside waiting. We stopped in a gift shop so I could get my dad a gift and grab a drink, and he followed us there too. Finally, my mom has had more than enough but isn't going to confront him personally, because he hasn't done anything technically or engaged us in a very suspicious way yet. So we go back to our gate where my mom tells the lady by the plane entrance what's been going on since Nashville, and she called security. These 2 huge security guards come down to our gate and start talking to my mom, who says very loudly and pointing, "That man has been following us since we arrived at the airport in Nashville. He's making us very uncomfortable." After telling them the full story and hearing my mom being loud and seeing her pointing directly at him, the bookstore guy takes off running. So security called for backup and followed him, and like 2 minutes later, we boarded our plane for Austin without the creepy guy. I live in Oklahoma, right in the middle of Tornado Alley. Extreme weather drills have been a frequent part of school life for decades, long before kids had to deal with all the other emergency drills. I went to middle school back in the 90s, and I have clear memories of huddling on the floor in the interior hallways of my school, with the lights off and my butt basically sticking up in the air, at least once a month for years. As a girl, I always felt uncomfortable, like I was exposing myself to all the teachers that were walking down the hall. But no matter what I said, I would be forced to follow instructions. I came to dread the extreme weather lockdowns more than the idea of a deadly tornado itself. A tornado might hit nearby once in a blue moon, but I felt like I had no choice but to moon all the weirdest teachers at school every month. Even worse, the lockdowns actually happened more often than that, because real extreme weather situations are very common during certain times of the year. One day in May of my 7th grade year, such a situation occurred. At the time, my classroom was one of the temporary buildings they put up around the school to alleviate overcrowding. Everyone called them portables, but they weren't portable. They were just flimsy buildings. That day, as the howling winds grew louder and the haunting wail of the tornado sirens droned on, and the chit-chat stopped, and a real sense of dread clouded over us. Initially, there was a morbid anticipation mixed in with it. I was a little excited to experience a real storm,
without having to be concerned about my home getting destroyed. I didn't care if the school got wrecked, as long as I didn't get hurt, but it seemed unlikely that it would be like that. There was a part of me that actually hoped there would be a tornado. It would make showing my rear end to the weird chorus teacher worth it. The hope didn't last long, however. It was already dark inside, because the lights were off. But at the start, there was still natural light coming in from outside. Over the course of mere minutes, the storm began to block out the sun, until it felt like an unnatural night had descended upon the world. The winds continued to get stronger, shaking the doors, like the storm itself was trying to beat its way in. Then the hail came, smacking against the door like a volley of meteors. Before long, the once quiet, hushed hallway was afflicted with a cacophony of noise. Fear gripped everyone. It was palpable. That's when the telltale sound whispered into our ears. Quiet at first. The low, grumbling, growing roar of rushing winds like a passing freight train, steadily intensifying, as we all knew the monster was drawing near. It was undeniable by then. Even if we couldn't see it, that a tornado was on the ground and not far away. And with every passing second, it seemed more and more certain that it would hit us directly. A lot of kids started to cry. The teachers yelled at us to stay calm, but they couldn't conceal the fear in their voices. When the walls started to shake, they finally took cover too. For a few minutes, we were all equalized in this compromising position that was supposed to keep us safe. And now nobody had to be worried about anyone peeping at their crack. We all had greater concerns. The air itself vibrated at the frequency of a tornado. I could feel it in my chest. Outside, I heard carnage and destruction, debris slamming into the doors just to fly off into the distance in the next instant. It was like the world was getting shoved into a wood chipper. The most terrifying moment was when the windows couldn't take the stress anymore and shattered. A torrent of air rushed into the hall. The storm had finally found its way inside, and there's no more escaping it. It felt inevitable that the whole school was about to be ripped off its foundation, and all of us flung into the sky along with it. The procedure for anyone who found themselves in a portable at the time of a weather emergency was to immediately evacuate and take shelter in the main building of the school, leaving everything behind, including backpacks. Everybody got on the ground and covered their heads with their hands and sat in the most uncomfortable, awkward, and questionable position for much longer than we usually did in the drills. The teachers told us there was an extreme cyclonic thunderstorm with a high probability to produce tornadoes, heading straight for us, and that we wouldn't be allowed to get up and go back to class until it passed by. All of that was incomprehensible jargon to me at the time, but they are words I have since learned to take seriously. Most of the time, those lockdowns felt ridiculous and overdone. I clenched my teeth and I prayed. I'm sure we all prayed. Somehow, by God's grace, it worked. Just when we thought it was about to stomp on our heads, it began to grow quieter. At last, we could all breathe a sigh of relief. Over the next few minutes, all the growing signs of danger that preceded the tornado reversed and undid themselves. Until the sun shined once again, and the air was still. After waiting several more minutes to be safe, the lockdown was finally lifted, and we could stand up. My legs and back were sore, but I was unscathed. The school was intact, and I could go back to class and get my stuff. Except that wasn't entirely true. The main building was damaged, but still standing, I guess. But as I walked outside to the field of portables, I witnessed the true devastation that had just unfolded. The portables were just gone. Besides a bit of rubble and some pipes sticking out the ground, there wasn't a single trace left of them. Not even cinder blocks remained. Everything I had in my bag was erased. My scrapbook, my notebooks, my diary, all of it taken far away with no hope of having it returned. Knowing that if I had stayed in my classroom during the tornado, that I would surely have been utterly destroyed along with it, put a feeling in my chest I'll never forget. It's hard to describe realizing you've come so close to death at such a young age. Ever since then, I've never taken the threat of severe weather lightly. It is a part of my life in Tornado Alley, but I was born and raised in Oklahoma, and it's where I will stay.